Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Janine Green ASB Chats. I'm Janine Green. I'm a self-employed consultant working in antisocial behaviour, providing support to local authorities and social housing providers in terms of how they best tackle ASB and support victims. Now, you have found me sitting at home in my pyjamas because we're recording this episode smack bang in the middle of lockdown because of coronavirus. And I know that there's a high chance that many of you will be doing the same and will be listening to this podcast episode from the safety of home while you self-distance and follow the rules that we all find ourselves having to live our lives by. And therefore, when I was thinking about what the subject matter should be for this episode, it will probably come as no surprise that I thought it would be really useful for us to discuss around coronavirus and the issues that that has created in terms of ASB cases. So both in terms of how do we provide an ASB service when we find ourselves working remotely, and secondly, how has coronavirus impacted on the types of ASB cases that we receive and perhaps the numbers of them, and what are the challenges presented in terms of dealing with them? So I'm really pleased to welcome Rebecca Brown along today, who is the new chief executive at ASB Help, a national charity that works to support ASB victims. I'm not going to steal her thunder too much. She knows a great deal more about what she does than I do. So I'm going to throw it over to you, Rebecca. A huge thank you for taking time out from I know what's been a very busy period of time to talk to me. Can we start off by simply you introducing yourself in a little more detail and telling our listeners a little bit more about the work of ASB Help?
Of course. Thank you, Janine, for inviting me to be on your podcast from my bed this morning. Never did I think I would be doing this work from the comfort of my bed, which I'm starting to adapt to. But yes, my name is Rebecca Brown and I am pretty new into the role of CEO for ASB Help. ASB Help is a national charity, as you said, Janine, with the primary focus on making things better for victims of antisocial behaviour. And our existence came into being partly because of the tragic case of Fiona Pilkington, the death of her and her daughter, because she had suffered years and years of extreme antisocial behaviour and she felt no longer able to cope. So that was the seed of the charity, if you like. We're now quite a few years down the road and we do lots of other things. Although the primary remit is to make things better for victims, we recognise that by doing that, we have to be able to help practitioners, to be able to solve cases and investigate them and manage them in the best possible way. So we do a lot around best practice, education, getting out there and speaking to practitioners, whether they're in a housing provider setting, in a police force or in a local authority. And we do a lot to lobby the government to make changes that will better serve victims. So we work with the Home Office, with the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government. And we also work with the Victims Commissioner and the National Police Chiefs Association. So we do lots of things. We will be developing a practitioner website in the next few weeks because we've got a bit of lockdown time to do that. But we still occasionally deal with sort of the higher end cases of antisocial behaviour and see if we can assist to give some advice and do our best to promote a solution.
That's great. A really lovely comprehensive introduction to the charity. What we will do before we end this episode, if that's okay with you, Bex, is talk a little bit about how practitioners can keep in touch and find out a little bit more. I think it's really interesting and perhaps some of our listeners didn't know that you're there to support practitioners as well. So I think now you drop that little nugget, it's probably a good idea for us to share how people do get in touch.
Absolutely.
So My second question then is really around the kind of situation that we find us in at the moment. So you've mentioned the fact that you do a lot of work around lobbying government and working with Home Office and other stakeholders, that you do a lot to support practitioners. So have you seen an impact that coronavirus has created in terms of the amount of ASB, but also the types of ASB that organisations are seeing reported?
Well, the primary inquiry we've had has been from government departments and practitioners, especially in local authorities, asking our advice on, you know, how do we deal with things? We know there's going to be an increase in antisocial behaviour. That is common sense, like there is in domestic abuse. We know confining people in a lockdown situation is going to create some tensions, especially when people are fearful. So they've come to us mainly asking, you know, how can we adapt to what we're doing? And we've given them some ideas, and I'm sure that's something we'll discuss later on in this podcast. Mm. The immediate increases we've seen have been things like noise nuisance, fly tipping. We've also seen those, and I think this is one of the bigger risks of the situation we're in, is those low to mid-level cases of antisocial behaviour that maybe haven't been resolved for some time, the sort of, if you like, drip effect cases, that, you know, they could potentially reach, you know, quite an explosive outcome because of all the other factors that are now making what was already a difficult case quite explosive, if you like. So we've seen that, but we've also seen lots of issues with social distancing. So it's been an interesting, from the point of, you know, looking at the legislation and understanding, because we're well aware that lots of people out there don't always understand what antisocial behaviour encompasses, but we're getting lots of social distancing cases, especially in flats and older person schemes. We're seeing that come through. And that's closely related to residents or members of society that may have drug and alcohol dependencies. And so they've, in some cases, been very dismissive of the government's requirements to socially distance and, you know, also being unwilling to do that because they have to feed a drug and alcohol habit.
I think, I mean, certainly I've got a number of clients. I also chair the West Midlands Local Authority managers meetings. And certainly most people that I've been speaking to have said that the social distancing thing has become a problem. And it certainly seems to be that because we're seeing so much difference in the way police forces are picking up the powers that have been created around dealing with social distancing issues, like the fines that we've heard about. We've obviously got some police forces that have been a little bit more kind of ready to go ahead and issue lots and lots of fines and then perhaps come under scrutiny for that. And then equally, we've got the opposite end of the scale of forces saying that they're not issuing any fines and they're starting with a very persuasive approach to start with. And I think what some of the local authorities and social housing providers are therefore finding, that they're having lots of reports around social distancing, but because perhaps the police haven't been quite so proactive around taking on some of those calls or dealing with some of those reports. And I suppose one of the questions I've been talking around with my clients is social distancing antisocial behaviour? And I suppose I'd be interested to get your view on that, Rebecca, in terms of the tools that we've got available. And do we think social distancing is something that can be dealt with through ASB legislation?
Well, yes, I do. Absolutely, I do. Because I think when we look at sort of the tests, if you like, in the legislation, we're looking at if a behaviour can cause a significant risk of both physical and mental harm. Well, you know, if you're not going to follow the government's requirements on social distancing, and you then say go into an over 55s residence, where people may already have, you know, terminal health conditions or vulnerabilities that maybe put them in the shielded program, then you can see the risk here. If somebody is deliberately refusing to socially distance and is going out, say, you know, 10, 20 times a day, being in touch with other people, that they're naturally they're at risk of exposing themselves and for whatever reason, possibly a drug or alcohol issue, they may not value their own health as much, but then they're also putting what can be a group of very vulnerable people at risk, because we have to remember lots of sheltered housing schemes or over 55 schemes, they come with communal facilities like laundries. I imagine common rooms will probably be closed, but you still have to do your washing and you might still have to go into those communal areas to get by and just do the basics that you have to do. So if you've got another resident who may be bringing the visitors in and they're touching door handles and surfaces and going into all these areas, and you know, let's be honest, nobody really knows. There's no definitive on how long the virus lasts anywhere. Potentially, you know, they're just putting an additional risk in place, which is not necessary. So yes, I do believe it's antisocial behaviour. And I think the point on the police is, and I've used this word so many times, and I've heard this word being used quite often at the daily government press briefings, which is unprecedented.
Oh, well, I don't hear that word anymore.
but in fairness, it is unprecedented. That's what it is. And it's not just unprecedented. It comes with all these other factors and emotions where, you know, people are legitimately fearful and going almost through waves of emotions. And I think when it comes to, say, the police have been given this task, I can understand why there's maybe a lack of consistency throughout the country. And I think that's unfortunate, but I think this legislation, the Coronavirus Act, had to be put into place so quickly that there had to be some flexibility for officers to deal with issues that may be more local to them than, say, maybe a national problem. But I think because there's a lack of consistency, that has put an extra burden on local authorities and housing providers. But I think we must also keep in mind that, you know, there is absolute clarity out there for every resident, individual citizen of this country that we have to socially distance. So I'm pretty certain there's no police officer out there that wants to come into contact with anybody to issue them with a fine or words of advice if they really don't have to. Yeah. So I think there has to be some leeway. But yes, like everything, there's always maybe, you know, an individual that sort of goes a bit further than is necessary. But I think the unprecedented nature of the times means we also have to understand there has to be a bit of flexibility, because, you know, most people want to do the right thing and most people want to get the job done and keep people safe. And the majority of people out there are just doing that. And that is the same for, you know, for the police and for tenancy enforcement or antisocial behaviour enforcement. But I do wonder if the government, in its rush to get the Coronavirus Act together, potentially missed a trick, and maybe missed a trick in the using, you know, the powers and tools of the Antisocial Behaviour, Crime and Policing Act. Like I alluded to earlier, the threshold of significant risk of physical or mental harm can be applied to COVID-19 cases. And there's lots of powers in there, which I imagine we'll probably talk about later on, that could be applied in this situation. And I did advise on I believe, the first COVID-related injunction only, I think it was last week or the week before now. So, you know, we know the tools can be used to deal with these cases.
Yeah, and I think, I very much share the same view as you. I mean, the very helpful thing, which we've known to be incredibly valuable for years, but has particularly become valuable in relation to these kind of cases, is the fact that the definition is causing or likely to cause nuisance, yes, annoyance, or causing or capable of causing harassment, alarm or distress. And I think certainly if you were, as you say, if you were someone living in an over 60s scheme, for example, and somebody was coming into the local area and, you know, ignoring social distancing rules, then I think absolutely it goes without saying that test is going to be met, which then opens up the opportunity for the ASB tools. I think, I suppose from my point of view, I think the important thing to underpin is we're not, I certainly don't think we're saying that local authorities and social housing providers should be getting involved in every single issue of social distancing in terms of looking at injunctions on every type of report. And that very much, it goes back to what we kind of promote all the time, which is, it's not just looking at the behaviour, but it's looking at the risk of harm. And I think your scenario where, you talked about the fact that, you know, if it's happening in an area where you've got people who are more vulnerable, then of course that behaviour is more serious, and that might be where we're looking at kind of enforcement action. And I certainly know of quite a few of my clients who are doing things like putting together advisory letters, or be it on their own or in partnership with the police, with kind of everybody's badge at the top to show that it's a partnership letter that's being used in the first instance when a report of social distancing comes in the hope that perhaps it is just a misunderstanding, a misinterpretation of the advice we've been given, and hoping that that alone will be enough to stop the problems. So I think there are lots of different sort of tacks that organisations are taking out there. But I think what we're saying is, the bottom line is, the ASB tools are available in the right situations, and that it certainly is something that could satisfy the test for antisocial behaviour.
Yes, I agree with that. And I think, you know, the guiding principles of any, you know, antisocial behaviour management is this fair, reasonable and proportionate. And, you know, my practitioner experience would lend me to believe that in the majority of cases, when a problem is brought to your attention, it can be resolved simply by an informal intervention, but a quick intervention. You know, it can't be left for weeks, but that simple, straight away, off the bat, get in touch with, you know, the victim or victims and alleged perpetrators, get as much information as you possibly can to inform, you know, your strategy for managing the case. Now, in a COVID-19 related, say, noise nuisance situation, it might simply be a case of, you know, certainly we would maybe normally advise the victim in a straightforward noise nuisance case, if there's no other risks, to go and speak to the neighbour. Obviously, that cannot happen. But, you know, if they've got other means of contacting the neighbour, and they say, you know, have a decent-ish relationship with them, they could maybe use text message, a phone, email, WhatsApp, any of those platforms. But if that's not possible, and and that has to be brought to the attention of an antisocial behaviour practitioner, then, you know, a phone call to the alleged perpetrator or the neighbour, and just say, you might not realise, because, you know, we're in this situation and everybody's going a bit stir crazy, you might not realise that, you know, your music's a little bit loud. And you know, a gentle reminder, and that will usually do the trick, you know, because that's what we need to do. We have to be able to negotiate with people and explain to people that, you know, look, this isn't going to go on forever. We will get there in the end. But, you know, have you thought about using headphones for a bit, you know, and make some suggestions? But I think the name of the game is to get in there quickly, to have a good rapport with the person you're speaking to, and just explaining that, you know, the difficult times, but, you know, we don't want to make it any more difficult than it has to be, and we all have to live together.
And I think you make a number of really good points there. I think a lot of this is going to come down to tolerance. And, you know, your point about perhaps an officer needs to, in some situations, adopt a slightly softer approach than they might do usually. Because, you know, we might be living in circumstances where suddenly we find we've got a family of five that have to be inside, you know, 23 hours a day, apart from when they go out to do their walk. And that's obviously going to be a higher level of noise that comes with that. So I think you make some incredibly good points. I mean, I'm part of a choir, and we are doing virtual rehearsals at the moment. And 10 o'clock this morning, I was singing at the top of my voice in my terrace house. I'm sure my neighbour heard that. And I am also 100% sure that it caused them a nuisance and annoyance. Probably some harassment, alarm, distress as well.
You know, I'm sure that's not the case, Janine.
I'm not going to prove to you otherwise. But I would hope that given the situation that we find ourselves in, that my neighbours aren't going to go and report that to the council. And I would also hope that if they did, that the council would perhaps, as I said, take a slightly softer view in terms of contacting me to discuss the issues, rather than jumping in with 2 feet and kind of threatening to get an injunction out against me or, you know, a noise abatement.
Oh, I would hope so. That might be a little bit excessive.
But I also think there's a danger there, isn't there, as well, about creating a kind of inflaming a situation, because, yeah, you know, taking that kind of scenario that I've painted quite comically, but if I got a warning letter from the council because of that, then I could perhaps be quite pissed off with my neighbour for doing that, and, you know, quite annoyed and frustrated, yeah, which is then gonna strain relationships between me and my neighbours. So I think there's a bit of a responsibility on everybody at the moment, isn't there? Like, neighbours to be maybe a little bit more tolerant, and officers to perhaps be a little bit softer with some of this stuff.
Absolutely. And I think in the course of any management of a case of antisocial behaviour, one must always risk assess the victim and the perpetrator, but risk assess the case, because at no point do you want to make a case near unsolvable without legal action. And you don't want to escalate it and then compound it and maybe draw other people into it. Because the last thing you want, and, you know, I can see this happening quite easily, is, you know, a phone call, you're in breach of your tenancy agreement, you've been causing noise nuisance, X, Y, and Z, bring it to an end, this is a tenancy warning. Because, you know, there's a good risk there that that person would be rightly quite annoyed. And then the next thing, the messaging all the neighbours or using social media to say, yeah, so-and-so from number 22, you'll never believe what they've done. They've just grassed me up. And then, you know, the next thing, you could have a whole street that's just in absolute chaos, and noise nuisance then becomes something a lot more serious. And then by the end of the week, there's threats to kill, and I'm going to put petrol through your letterbox. You definitely don't want to end up with that situation. And I think we have to understand, and I can't get this point across like any stronger than I have been, which is, when people are frightened, the behaviour alters. I have seen that in my own way of working, because you get up and you think, God, I feel like something really bad's going to happen. And I'm like, oh, it must have just been a bad night's sleep. And then you look at the news like, oh, no, something bad is happening. Mm. We're in the middle of a national crisis and a pandemic. And so you've got to really keep your own emotions in check. And, you know, if you're not used to doing that, or you already have problems doing that, which lots of people do, then I can see how that can inflame a situation and compound some existing issues, and before you know it, you know, we've got big problems. So I think every practitioner must be mindful of their own mental well-being, but also, you know, that people's responses might seem a little bit different or unusual, or maybe, you know, indicative of somebody, you know, entering a real crisis point in the life, because, you know, the pandemic is doing bad things to people across the world, and nobody really knows how to cope with that.
Look, I think you're absolutely right, and I'm not ashamed to say that there are mornings that I wake up and I just cry. And, you know, it's a very, very challenging world we're living in, and we're all very, very worried. We're worried for ourselves, we're worried for our family, we're worried for the world as a whole, and our emotions are up and down. And I know those days where I am crying into my cornflakes, that if my neighbour suddenly started playing some music, that actually that's probably going to cause me some real distress. And I think our resilience is massively affected. And I suppose, yes, what I would really like to take from, I think, the incredibly valuable point that you've just made, is that we need to almost shift our view on risk and vulnerability a little bit. Whereas, you know, before we might have seen things as being quite low level, if we want to use that terrible term. We've got to think about the impact even more.
Absolutely.
So people's resilience is going to be much more lower in some situations, and therefore we can't judge the ASB cases that are happening at the moment with the same lens that we might have done 6 months ago.
Well, Janine, I don't think we should ever judge an ASB case based on the actual behaviour. I'm a big believer in it should be judged in addition on the impact. And if there's been a number of incidents, it's a cumulative impact. So absolutely agree with you that we do have to change the lens a bit. But as good practice anyway, we should always be looking at the impact. Because you know what, Janine? If I live next door to you and I'm listening to your singing at 10 o'clock in the morning, I might think, you know what, how long is this going to go on for? But I'd be all right with it. But what if you're living next door to somebody with a serious mental health concern, maybe some paranoia, some schizophrenia, you know, one of the big range of issues. And, you know, that could have a huge impact. And especially, not saying that you're antisocial, Janine, but, you know, if you're doing it all day, that would be possibly considered antisocial. And if your neighbour maybe, you know, just lives in absolute quiet and is not used to it, then, and maybe they're dealing with, you know, a family member in hospital and they've got their own pressures, I can understand why the impact would be a lot more serious now. But, you know, as I say to every practitioner, you always look at the impact, full stop. That has to be a central point.
Absolutely. And I think this is why, you know, we now try and avoid ASB policies, lists all the behaviours that aren't ASB, because how can we possibly do that without looking at the circumstances around them as well? So yes, I think it's an incredibly good point. And again, I suppose I just repeat the point that people's tolerances, resilience, ability to cope with things are going to be very different at the moment, and we need to take that into account.
I do also think, Janine, that where there is a serious case, a serious risk, then that has to be dealt with as it is, which is this is a serious matter and it has to be dealt with as such. And I think there's a risk when we're all feeling overwhelmed because we don't know what's going to happen. I think there's a risk that practitioners, you know, take that being overwhelmed to the now home office. And they think, well, how can I possibly deal with this now? You know, I can't do this, can't do that. And then maybe blinded to the opportunities that are available to them, you know, because lockdown, you know, for some offices, you know, it was business as usual. And then, you know, one morning people get a text message from the manager saying, don't come into work. So there was not that much preparation time. It all came out of the blue. You know, they don't have access to the files in their offices, or some of them don't have access to the systems. Think, well, what can I possibly do? But I do think it's important that, you know, victims and practitioners are aware that things still can be done, and things can be still done quickly in the majority of circumstances. And so, you know, just because we've got this situation doesn't mean you have to put up with antisocial behaviour. Yes, we want you to accept you need to be more tolerant, and everybody needs to do that. But if you are a victim of antisocial behaviour, you have the right to get some help with that. And the practitioners that are managing these cases have a responsibility to do something about them, and they still can.
And I think you're absolutely right. And I'm not going to use this opportunity to name and shame, but I do remember the conversation we had about a week ago where we were quite astonished to come across a council that was giving out the message that they weren't dealing with any ASB at the moment because of the current environment.
And oh, yes.
You know, that's absolutely shocking and completely and utterly wrong. What you've done very nicely, Rebecca, is set us up for the next question, which is around the fact that this is causing operational challenges. And, you know, while it's certainly not an excuse to do nothing, it is going to mean that we have to somewhat change the way we case manage with cases of ASB. Can you talk me through some of the ways that you've seen organisations maybe change their approach? Talk about some of the advice that you might have for practitioners who are case managing issues remotely.
Yeah, so I've had sort of every extreme. So, you know, the low level, sorry, the worst term in the world. So minor noise nuisance that didn't occur before COVID-19, which, you know, as I've explained, I would deal with via a phone call in the first instance and negotiate. And then right the way through to, you know, ex parties sort of without notice injunctions for COVID related social distancing, antisocial behaviour. So that certainly the challenge for the injunction and the claimant and the defendant, well, there was actually two defendants, must remain nameless. But in that case, the practical issues for the practitioner were, well, how do I get a witness statement signed? And so I said, well, there's two options. You know, you can get a witness statement unsigned and, you know, any judge in the land is going to understand why you couldn't do that. Or you could get a witness statement, but exhibit it with your housing management statement. So, you know, so that covers you. And that is, in fact, what the practitioner did. The other problems were, how do we ensure if we are asking a court to restrict somebody's liberty and freedom of movement, which, yes, it mirrors the government's social distancing requirements, but if we're giving them quite very defined clauses on what they can and cannot do, how do we make sure that everything they need is they may need in terms of food delivery is being catered for? So in this situation, there was some support workers involved, and I suggested to the practitioner, right, go to them, get, you know, see if you can get an email from them with a commitment to, look, this is the level of care we will provide and this is what it will include. So a court will be satisfied that, we're not asking for somebody to be left without any food or access to food. We need to be very clear with these people about what they can and cannot do. So that was one option around that. The case itself was heard via video link. I understand there are a couple of problems with, I think it's BT Connect, which was problematic, but that worked. And the return hearing was actually so that was at the court, which did surprise me, but it was listed for a return hearing with the defendants to arrive, but the defendants chose not to contest the injunction and accepted it. So they never did end up going. I understand that the claimant applied for alternative service, and so the injunction orders were put through the letterbox and by a process server, following social distancing requirements, who could then complete the certificate of service. So that they're the two extremes, but I think the sort of the middle of the other options, which I think perhaps some practitioners have maybe not thought about, would be, for example, you know, a good neighbour agreement. If you've got, say, a street of lots of problems, you know, there's nothing to stop you looking at something like a good neighbour agreement, just to sort of get that out there. Look, we're not blaming one household. We're not saying there's a problem with one or two of you. We're just reminding you that in this difficult time, you know, these are the things that we must all do so that we get along well and there aren't problems. There's always, obviously, you can issue warnings, verbal, or formal warnings. They can be adapted. They can be done over the phone. They can be done, by email. And I would just stress that make sure you make a note of everything. If you're going to issue a formal warning to somebody, make sure that you add a section at the bottom saying, you know, this formal warning has been served in this particular way, and that is because of COVID-19 and social distancing. So always cover yourself, but because you might have to adapt doesn't mean you can't do things. And any good antisocial behaviour practitioner is used to having to adapt, because when you're dealing with complex human behaviour, lots of sort of problems that are like curveballs at every junction, you learn to adapt. And, you know, it's never good practice to get a report of a case and immediately determine the strategies to deal with it, because, you know, you have to do your investigations, which you can still do with COVID-19. Mm. It limits your abilities because, you know, I always find best practices to visit both victims and perpetrators, because you know, you never really get the full picture unless, you know, you're in somebody's space and you can maybe see that, oh, maybe this person's got some other issues. Maybe that's the root cause of the problem. You know, the property looks chaotic. They haven't opened the mail for what looks like 2 years, or there's some random person sat in the background that's potentially controlling or coercing. All those things, yes, you're not going to be able to do now. But there's still a lot you can achieve through a verbal conversation. I think, you know, it's the art of negotiation that will then enable you to think, well, look, what's the next best thing? While you keep in mind all the time, I need to try and formulate a solution without the risk of an escalation.
And I think you raise quite a good point there, which is around we may be doing things differently. We may be doing things in a way that under normal circumstances might not be seen as best practice. And I suppose what comes into my mind there is about the impact that this might have on future work. So we might be dealing now with a case that in 6 months, 12 months time requires legal action. And we might be acting in a way at the moment that could be undermining what our ASB policy says. So I don't know, yeah. Perhaps our ASB policy says that we go out and visit the perpetrator like you've just described. So I think it's really important that where we are taking action 6 to 12 months down the line or wherever, that we're explaining in our housing management statement or our applicant statement why we may have breached our ASB policy and the reasons for that, so that we're not actually giving Absolutely. The defence an opportunity to challenge the action that we're taking. So I think that's a really good point. And I suppose I would be encouraging officers now that where they are documenting their actions, if it is being done in a different way or it's being done in a way that could be seen as a breach of policy and procedure, there's a file note justifying that action so that any future legal challenges can be overcome. I think there
I can't see how you would be as long as you're acting fairly, reasonably and proportionately and you've kept a record of everything, I cannot anticipate you being unfairly criticised for taking action, but adapting that action mm-hmm. in this situation, because I would say the criticism would come if there was just straightforward inaction, because that wouldn't.
I totally agree with you. I suppose I'm coming from it. Let's not even give the defence the opportunity to raise it. Let's cut it off and address it immediately in the statements or on our documents why we've done it. Because I think you're absolutely the sympathies with the. From the judge are going to be absolutely with you and the fact that you've done something in such challenging circumstances. I find it quite interesting the point you raised about kind of neighbour issues. You know, you mentioned sort of good neighbour agreements if you've got lots of people in a street causing problems or acting inappropriately. And I guess what triggered in my mind around that was that there is a real risk at the moment of kind of community tensions arising. I guess I'm thinking of the scenario where you've got somebody kind of flouting community sort of distancing rules, and having a barbecue in their garden and inviting friends and family around. I imagine the neighbours are going to be pretty irate about that, and that could cause some difficulties. So I think this idea of there being situations where there's problems between neighbours is something that's actually quite likely to occur.
I agree.
What I've seen, which I've found quite interesting, is the fact that things like mediation don't have to stop. That actually a lot of mediation companies are flexing their services in light of the current challenges and offering a lot of things remotely over the internet, etc.
Yeah.
So mediation things are still going ahead, but they're going ahead online.
Yeah, I think that is correct. I think you have to be a very proactive practitioner to get something like that in place quickly. And I do think there's costs associated with that that some people would be unwilling to fund. But I absolutely recognise, and I think we've seen a few cases in the news, of people blatantly breaching social distancing and having group barriers. And all that, and you get in a sit, you know, and I feel so sorry for the people that live next door that are trying to decide, well, this is wrong, is putting people at risk, but if I ring the police, will my neighbours find out I've rung the police? You know, now must always, you know, reaffirm that you can make anonymous reports to the police, and it is the correct thing to do to ring the police in that situation if people are blatantly flouting the rules and putting other people at risk. But I can see this increasing, because I do think we're going to enter a phase of complacency or frustration with lockdown. And although we don't really know when this is going to end, and everybody's guessing, and there's lots of conflicting reports, but the weather is getting warmer, which would be a trigger point for any ASB anyway. Yeah. And then combined with, you know, maybe becoming complacent and thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe finding a way to justify why it's then acceptable to, you know, have a birthday party, have a big barbecue, have a wedding, whatever. So I can see how that's gonna cause further problems. And I think the difficulty in those situations is, yes, the police can deal with that as an urgent matter. But what happens if this is a tenancy or it's an owner-occupier? What's the next thing? And I fear there aren't the systems in place for the police to be able to get through to a local authority or a landlord and just say, look, can you send this household a warning letter? You know, unless relationships are really strong in that particular area. And I think something like that does need to be followed up in that way. And that would be, you know, a proactive approach to mitigating against further situations like that. Whether that can be done quickly, I'm not sure. But I think that would maybe be best practice. I think the other risk we've got now as well. So I'm, you know, apart from, you know, the barbecues, and things like that, we've got the risk of the longer lockdown goes on. And, you know, if people who maybe have made some false assumptions that, you know, they're in this situation because of a particular person or a particular group mm-hmm. of people. Or, you know, and that could be, well, you know, we're in this situation and one of my relatives is in hospital because you infected them, or I think you look like you're from China and that's where this virus has come from, so you're responsible. And we have seen cases of this nature around the world. I've not heard of any just yet in the UK. But I do think this will be a problem. And so I think we'll also see, in addition to an increase in antisocial behaviour and domestic abuse, hate crimes as well. And I think we have to be mindful that those crimes that is also antisocial behaviour, but that has to be dealt with robustly and quickly. And as a priority before it escalates.
That might be the cases where we are looking more and more at using things like the injunction to be able to get in quickly and support the victims of those kind of situations.
Absolutely.
So you've already kind of mentioned the fact that you helped recently advise a registered provider on securing an injunction in light of coronavirus-related issues. I guess that's something that a lot of organisations are thinking about at the moment. I know you mentioned that you can't name the respondents in the matter, but are you able to provide us a little bit more detail about what the actual behaviour was, what the situation was, just to give the listener a bit more of an understanding of where they've been used and how?
Yeah, so the situation involved an over 55 sheltered housing complex, and I understand it was one resident and a friend of the resident with alcohol dependency issues who were refusing to follow the government social distancing rules. So, you know, and so it was quite excessive what they were doing, but we're talking like on, you know, between 10 and 20 occasions going out to the shops to buy alcohol or other things, and then coming back into the scheme, which it was unnecessary. So it's unnecessary for anybody to go out to the shop that many times. They were given numerous warnings. The ramifications were explained, the risks were explained, but the behaviour persisted, and so the claimant had no alternative but to put something, you know, formal in place to protect both that resident and the visitor and the other residents in the scheme.
And was that injunction secured on a without notice basis?
Yes, so it was without notice. So I think I was asked for advice on the Friday and it was in court on the Monday morning. So that's how quick it was put together. And I think once, you know, and obviously there was no best practice to use. It was, you know, there was a bit of guesswork. What clauses do we ask for? So, you know, it's thinking outside the box and thinking, right, you know, this is all new to us, but, you know, what is the best thing we can do to make sure that these victims are not put at extra risk? It was incredibly quick. And it was, you know, dealt with straight away. And actually it was served, I think within about 5 hours. So it was in place very quickly.
Amazing. Shows what can happen when we put efforts in. And I said, again, I think it just underpins the point that you made, that the wrong thing to do is assume that this situation means that we can't do anything. The tools are still there if we've got an immediate risk that we need to deal with. I've noticed via social media that you've been doing some work with the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government in terms of issuing some guidance around how organisations can tackle ASB in the current climate. Can you tell us a little bit more about that work that you're doing and what that might result in?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's an urge. I think before COVID-19, there was an urgent need for some practitioner guidance to be out there and available to everybody. But in this situation, the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government have come to us and said, look, what do you think could happen? What do you think in terms of antisocial behaviour? What are the risk points? And what do you think we can advise practitioners through, you know, through our platform that they should be still doing and they can still do? So I think, you know, my advice in terms of, you know, where I think the flashpoints could be is, as I mentioned before, those drip effects cases. And so, you know, some of my advice was, you know, if you're a practitioner, make sure you prioritise your most vulnerable victims. You know who they are. Make sure you are in regular contact with them. You establish regular contact patterns with them and you continually update the vulnerability and risk assessments you will have already have completed. But you also need to be negotiating with perpetrators and explaining to them that, you know, just because we've got a pandemic doesn't mean to say that your behaviour will go unpunished unless you do something about it now. So I think, yeah, there, certainly for existing cases, it's really important that, you know, although we have to adapt and be a little bit more flexible, serious antisocial behaviour is not going to go unpunished. It might not be punished in the next few weeks, but, you know, and it could be a year down the line, but you're not going to get away with that behaviour and you do stand to put yourself at risk. So I think that was certainly one piece of advice. I think my other advice to the ministry was, you know, I've got concerns about those areas where there's organised crime groups operating and have established themselves for a long time in a community and effectively are the community. And they are providing, say, the services that, you know, that maybe the government are or the local authority aren't. So, for example, things like, you know, are they also masquerading as loan sharks? So, you know, people are being compromised or, you know, they're now in a situation where maybe they can't access any alternative. So, you know, it's easier and some people may feel their only option to go to somebody associated with an organised crime group to borrow money from them. Certainly drug and alcohol users, you know, where are they going to get their drugs and alcohol? So my concern is what will happen in those communities, which quite often will have not reported as consistently as a community that doesn't have an organised crime group operating. They're almost self-governing, some of these communities. Yeah. And I think, well, you know, people will end up reporting things because, you know, I'd like to think organised crime groups cannot provide ventilators and medical care. Who knows? I'm yet to be proved wrong, but who knows? So this is the point where potentially these areas then do start reporting and have no alternative because their lives are at risk. So I think there's certainly some flashpoints that could happen there. I think also there is some of those communities is, well, you know, we've got some opportunities here. We've got some opportunities for acquisitive crimes. We've got some opportunities to behave antisocially. And, you know, what's anybody going to do about it? Because if the police are busy, already under-resourced, and then busy dealing with COVID-19, we can pretty much get away with anything. I think that was one of my other concerns. And certainly the impact of warm weather. And I did make mention of cases of domestic abuse, and those being managed in the capacity of an antisocial behaviour case where the domestic abuse is causing significant distress to neighbours as well. So I talked quite a lot about that, but I think my suggestions to the ministry were that, look, everything must be documented. Enforcement can still happen, but we must keep our absolute focus on the safety of the victims and looking to de-escalate where possible, but using the tools and powers that we've got available. And I've always been concerned that maybe not everybody always knows what tools and powers are available. And I urge every practitioner, refresh your knowledge of the Antisocial Behaviour Crime and Policing Act 2014. Look at the updated guidance for frontline professionals that came out in August 2019. And, you know, be familiar with some of those things, because it may be that you work in a situation where you're so used to doing things in one way that you've not had the opportunity to try anything else. So you maybe don't know what else is available to use. And also, you know, I think any ASB practitioner knows that you never just go to a job as an ASB practitioner. You are lots of things when you go to a case of antisocial behaviour. Everything from a social worker, police officer, an enforcement officer, a counsellor. You wear so many hats. And I think we really need to put that into practice now, because we need to be aware that when we're dealing not just with perpetrators and victims, that we need to add almost a layer of support into that communication. You must certainly always do that with your victims as standard, but with perpetrators as well. Because you know what? It could just be somewhat simple that you can still put in place, like an appointment with a drug and alcohol service or something, you know, over the phone that can de-escalate the situation. So you must always be assessing the needs and the risks of both your victims and your perpetrators, but also to, you know, to remind people as well, look, yeah, we've got a pandemic, every service is stretched, but if you are a victim of antisocial behaviour where there is a risk to life or property, you still call 999 and you report every other incident via 101 or your local council's online reporting system. And then to practitioners, you know, never delegitimize a complaint just because we're dealing with a pandemic. Never. Because again, this speaks to impact. But, you know, a complaint of antisocial behavior is still a complaint of antisocial behavior, whether there is a pandemic or not.
A huge amount of useful information in what you've just said, and actually I think that's a really lovely way of summarising the crux of much of our conversation. I think there's one thing that I'd just like to pull out of that, and I think your point very much about, you know, some practitioners are used to using only a very small part of the ASB toolkit, and I suppose I think really about the fact that we still have housing providers who rely quite heavily on tenancy and tenancy breaches. And I suppose in the environment that we're in, where we know that there's extensions on notice requirements for notice of seeking possessions and stays on court proceedings around those things, now is the time more than ever that we need to be thinking about the other tools that are available. And I think even if we don't know what those tools are, you know, we must reach out and ask. And there are lots of places where we can get help and support from, you know, be that our legal teams, be that coming and speaking to me, be that going to ASB help and speaking to you, Rebecca, you know, because it's not good enough that just because we've never used these things before, that we shouldn't reach out and find out what's possible, which I think lovely leads me into my final kind of point, which is, how do people find out more? So you mentioned the fact that ASB helps support practitioners as well. So how do listeners find out more? Where do they go to?
Well, by all means, come to our website, which is ASB Help, and you will find lots of resources on there, which at the minute are mainly designed for victims, but we are starting to add some practitioner resources onto that website, and we are in the process of developing a separate practitioner website. So certainly, you know, go on there, have a look at what we've got on our website, but look at also our Twitter feed, because, you know, we're updating Twitter, you know, most days, as soon as we become aware of some information that we think is of vital importance to practitioners, we are getting it out there. And, you know, today I've put out something today, I think it's just gone on now, you know, saying, look, these are your options as a practitioner. If you're dealing with a case, this is the suite of options available to you. Please do not think you cannot do anything to deal with a case. So that's where you can find us. We've got a Facebook page as well. But yeah, just Google ASB Help and you will find us.
Fantastic. And are you happy for me to share that suite of tools via my mailing list?
Absolutely, Janine. Yeah. And it's also gone to the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government. They're putting it out there as well. And we all have to work together. And that's across the board, but particularly in our field, which is quite underrepresented and not accredited. So we have to, you know, we have to make do, and we have to make this work, and we have to adapt. And we can only do that by talking to each other about, you know, well, what do you think about this? Could this work? Sharing best practice and being willing to listen and say, look, if you've got something you can't deal with, if I listen to it, maybe I can offer some suggestions. Mm. I think generally, not just dealing with antisocial behaviour, but the pandemic, we've all got to be, you know, willing to work together to overcome this.
And I think that sounds like a perfect soundbite to end this conversation on. Rebecca, just to say a huge, huge thank you for taking time out to chat with me. I think a lot of the stuff that you've raised, well, all of the stuff that you've raised has been incredibly helpful. And you like the way I backtrack there a little bit.
I
have no doubt that our listeners are going to have taken a huge amount of value from that. So thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you for inviting me, Jane.
No problem at all. That just leaves me to say thank you for listening over the last hour. I hope you found that beneficial and have taken a lot of practical knowledge and advice away. Just to open up some further offers, I'm finding myself with a little bit more time on my hands, so I'm doing lots more around kind of guidance and advice. So lots of free content that I'm pushing out there. So make sure you're following my social media presence, make sure that you're signed up for my mailing list to get hold of that stuff. And I guess what leaves me to say is, look after yourself and everybody else around you. Thank you very much, and until next time.